Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU libraries, and I'd like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. I'm delighted that you can come out this evening and hear what I think is going to be a very special evening of readings. Our guest tonight is Stephanie Mills. Stephanie Mills has written and spoken on ecology and social change since her time at Mills College as a student. Her writings include Whatever Happened to Ecology, an account of the evolution of her ecological consciousness and commitment, and In Service of the Wild, a book about restoring and re-inhabiting damaged land. Stephanie Mills edited In Praise of Nature, a compilation of reviews of and excerpts from major works of environmental literature, as well as Turning Away from Technology, a new vision for the 21st century, which reflects her choice in life to be, quote, willfully backward about technology, end quote. Today she makes her home in Michigan, fittingly, I think, in a place called Maple City. Please welcome Stephanie Mills.
Thank you, Peter. It's such an honor to be asked to read and to be doing so in a library. It's kind of a basilica of some kind. I'd like to begin by reading a little bit from my first book. I didn't start writing books till I got to Michigan. And this is from Whatever Happened to Ecology. A little voodoo. My favorite place on the planet is an indoor place, actually, my 8x12-foot writing studio. The long axis runs east-west. The door opens to the east. The horizontal peephole window in the back looks north to the hovel and all the other buildings on the property, including the tumble-down wooden barn. The picture window in front of the desk provides me a commanding view of a meadow that was once a cornfield. A small rectangular window frames the setting sun. It is a space so intimate and crammed with information, so thoroughly occupied by little objects, images, and effigies, all laden with memories and connotations, that it's like another cranium. Next to the west window, which now admits the iridescent, subtle glories of a late winter sunset, hangs a little watercolor that I painted months before I met Phil, my former husband who lured me to these climbs, months before I ever thought of Michigan as a place where I might live, in spite of the fact that both my paternal grandparents were born and raised a few hundred miles north of here on Michigan's Upper Peninsula. What's remarkable about the watercolor is that it's nearly an exact representation of the scene out the window, color for color and contour for contour. In the sky are the pearly striations of pink and azure and rose and lavender and ivory. There is the blinding gold and ruby whorl of the sun's orb. There is the rickrack of an evergreen stand shadowed in ultramarine blue, and the expanse of white in the middle distance flecked with saplings and other remnant vegetation. And in the foreground, a band of pink suggesting the glow that suffuses a snowfield at dusk. How did I come to see it? I painted it at a time when I never engaged in visual expression. I had all but abandoned that mode of understanding. But on the evening in San Francisco, when I painted the picture, I was at a point of despair. The desolation of the moment was crystallized by an improbable love affair. The frustration and confusion and finality of it had driven me first to my library looking for consolation. That literature offered none is a measure of the crisis. It was beyond the power of words to heal me, and perhaps less a job of garnering someone else's wisdom than of creating my own. It may be that I'd bankrupted my accustomed strategies. So I took out the paint box and watercolor block I'd inherited from my grandmother. What emerged was a vision of the place where I would embark upon the second half of my life. That vision is my rivet. Next, I'd like to read a little bit about Ultra Michigan, I think, the UP. This is from In Service of the Wild, which is about restoring and re-inhabiting damaged land. And, you know, even if you don't get to go to graduate school, if you're a writer, you're in a continuing education program. And it gives you a pretext to do great stuff. And in writing this book, which began with a suggestion from Barry Lopez, a wonderful nature writer, that I be paying more attention to the whole field of restoration ecology, I found that one of the most interesting questions in restoration ecology to me was, what do you restore to? And where do you go to get the images of primal landscapes and ecosystems? So that whole exploration occupied me for a while in working on this book, and I had the good fortune to run into some wilderness activists in the Upper Peninsula who were locating tracts of uncut old-growth Lake States forest in a region called the Michigami Highlands. And now that I've told you where it is, we're going to have to lock the door and just stay here till we die, because we don't want a whole lot of people trampling that place. Anyway, I got to go on a hike up there. My stereotype of virgin forest had mostly to do with the stupendousness of the trees. It turns out that the virginal quality lies not in grandeur, but in refraction. The highlands harboring these remnants are nowhere level, but are a tumult of defiles, slopes, faces, wetlands, groves, and pockets. It makes an uncommonly rich array of habitats, where every cubit is a world of its own. A raven croaked greetings, or possibly beat it, as we approached the rock cleft up which our party made its entry into the highlands and their revelation of ecological integrity. We hiked through dim, pure stands of old hemlock, past exquisite little iris bogs caught in depressions in the broken terrain, past sphagnum openings with palisades of white cedars up to a promontory looking out over lakes with rocky spruce-clad islands. In the canopy were occasional crimson sprays of sugar maple, already flaunting fall color. There were waterfalls and seeps, hewn basalt faces washed with moss, Indian pipes standing scarce and nacreous. No one yet has identified all the trees, shrubs, grasses, sedges, forbs, fungi, mosses, and lichens enmeshed in that wild redoubt. Indeed, such cataloging may be beyond possibility. This area contains a diversity of mite species believed to be equal to that of the tropical rainforest. An abundance of wildflowers lay underfoot, the mellifluously named Pipsissewa, snowberry, bunchberry, rattlesnake plantain, round-leafed orchis. We gobbled dewberries, blueberries, and huckleberries. Although we were loping, trying to see as much of the territory as possible during the long hours of summer daylight, in the moments when we paused, everywhere the eye alighted was a new constellation of living forms. Even within species, there was stunning variety. Trees of all ages were present, from yearling white pine feathers to soaring monarchs, three arm spans around, from elfin sugar maples fluttering their jaunty leaves to craggy old geysers whose trunks ascended out of view. There was a procession of generations, not orderly, but complete. Elsewhere in this region, where the topography is more forgiving, logging and pulp cutting have opened edges and acres of browse. White-tailed deer have erupted and pressed hungrily into the deeper woods, eating away the cedar and hemlock seedlings and tender plants of the forest floor. Where we were, only rogue bucks could survive the winters. A misstep into the shoulder-deep snow could make them easy game for the timber wolf and cougar, whose presence here is surmised from their tracks. Beautiful as the place was, its extraordinariness did not register until after we departed and were driving past endless pulp plantations of jack and red pine and high-tech larch. In some primal part of my being, I had recognized the virgin forest. Its wholeness was somehow familiar, and the organism that I am felt quite at home. Friends on the hike took photographs of us standing in a grove of virgin white pines. Later that year, I carried those pictures with me on my trip through India. I would consult them to remind myself of the splendors of the North Woods, of the immensity of those pearly trunks dwarfing any four of us in breadth, and reaching up past maple, hemlock, and birch to poke their windswept crowns up over the canopy. Compulsively, I showed these pictures to the people I met on my travels, wanting to share some sense of astonishment that such trees could exist anywhere, ever, and yet. It's amazing how time flies when you're doing something you enjoy. I don't know, if I see people snoozing off, I'll quit. I forget how to tell time when I'm in free fall. This is a portion of one of the essays from In Praise of Nature. This book was commissioned for Earth Day of 1990, but in light of recent events, I wanted to refer back to this. The book's divided into five parts: earth, air, fire, water, and spirit. When you're approaching the whole wide subject of environmentalism, subdividing it is tough, and so sometimes the old ways are the best. So this is from the essay on spirit. One October morning, I went into town to watch a friend teach a children's Aikido class. It was just getting light, the sky full of cottony gray rain clouds, the landscape heading toward winter. Much of the glowing gold and flame of the foliage had been dashed to the ground by recent rains and a snowfall. The new wetness was bringing out the intensity of the remaining colors, blackening the bark of the trees, etching their shape and character against the sky now that the cloak of leaves was ripped away. Cresting over the hill, I saw a sunrise causing the underside of the clouds to blush briefly, a glory over the saturated teal of the bay's waters. There was an epiphany in this, a moment of seeing the magic inherent in an everyday sight of farmland, sky, and shore. Onward into the ordinary reality of the town on an early Saturday morning, among my fellow citizens out on errands or looking for a little recreation, and out to the gym at the junior college. The class consisted of maybe a dozen children, most wearing the Aikido dogi, a simple, loose-fitting white costume donned and belted in a certain manner that connotes the principle of Aikido, non-resistance, a way of finding harmony. There were four adults, my friend teaching, three others helping. The kids ranged in age from 6 to 10, and there were more boys than girls. It was touching to watch these young ones trying something new, something foreign. Here were kids tasting a discipline, taking the big, visible risk of learning through trial and error. They all looked lithe and lean, compact and muscular as puppies, and were pretty much paying attention. Some were learning by observing. Others were not quite getting it. It was a world, that class, aquarium-like under the merciless gymnasium lights, engrossing, but not tender, unsentimental, and sometimes funny. Looking at those young ones, I ached, knowing that, much as I or any of us might desire it, I can't fix the world enough to forestall the suffering their lives will inevitably entail. Life, in her profligacy, exacts a huge toll. Rachel Carson, in At the Edge of the Sea, describes different oceanic and estuarian life forms, creatures whose spawn may number in the millions. And among those millions, perhaps only a few will survive into maturity. Most of them will be eaten. The implacable destiny of the individual organism is first to live and then to die. There's an undeniably tragic edge to this reality, that those Aikido kids, indeed all kids, are emerging into a world that will increasingly confound their parents and henceforth challenge them to the utmost, is pretty stark stuff. That none of us gets out of this one alive is starker still. Quite apart from one's initial subjective and self-interested responses, gloom and doom prophecies raise a tough question. What shall we bring in the way of spirit and psyche to times like these? Once at a gathering that consisted of predominantly middle-class white intelligentsia, I listened as Orrin Lyons, faithkeeper of the Onondaga Council of the Iroquois Confederacy, described concisely his people's lifeway, and out of that offered his own counsel for coming times. The wisdom that stuck was, much will be demanded of those to whom much has been given. Another thing he said was, don't look for mercy where there is none. Ours is a pivotal generation. We have to do more now than just live our little lives. We've got to become strong and enduring and respectful and speak to those qualities in one another. Civilization's mishaps have brought us to a time for growing up, not to despair and not to hate and not to frighten, but to engage one another compassionately, to confront lovingly, to embrace the entire reality and not to gainsay the pain are some pieces of the task. It might be said that spirit is the ultimate flowering of the survival instinct, its sweetest, wisest expression. The movement songs say you can't kill the spirit. Spirit, if it is invincible. But people are fragile, flesh and blood, discourageable. External circumstances work differently on different people, and there's no telling why. Where one human may rise in creative outrage against an injustice or senseless act of destruction, another may sink under the waves of deprivation or frustration. Despair, understandable enough in times like these, is perhaps the greatest threat to the flourishing of the human endowment of mind and spirit. Simple ignorance, not knowing even a few details of the infinite wonder of life's patterns in the biosphere, and hence not knowing what there is to care for, is another deadly threat. Injustice, racism, alienation, indifference, violence, sexism, loneliness, greed, the destruction of traditional cultures, and the rising levels of suffering that result from ecological deterioration. The list of threats to mind and spirit goes on and on. Perhaps because our century has seen the use of arms to resolve conflict develop toward a nuclear holocaust, it has also evoked brilliant avatars of nonviolent direct resistance, among whom Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. are most known and widely inspiring. Great leaders who forswore the use of violence in their struggles for deep social change. These leaders developed the use of what Gandhi called satyagraha, the force of truth itself, which force is an abiding, inclusive love. The unarmed Greenpeace warriors who buzz in their rubber zodiac boats between whales and whalers, and the earth firsters encamped high in Douglas firs or redwoods in ancient forests to avert logging and clear cutting, are heirs to this tradition of nonviolent direct action in the service of life. In contrast to the warrior heroism displayed in such actions, stands the patience and anonymity of the Greenham Common women's encampment in England, where since 1981, women have maintained a vigil in opposition to the installation of cruise missiles. Withstanding continual harassment and the vagaries of weather, these women are not storming the ramparts, but solemnly confronting the threat to all life posed by nuclear weaponry. Nonviolent direct action, silent witness, and civil disobedience are immensely powerful and righteous ways to work for change. The earth and ecology are not just an idea. The world is real, and human ecological sustainability consists in hundreds of individual physical practices and disciplines, every one of which can be performed as a ritual gesture of respect for the planet that gives us life. Going on litter patrol in the park, starting a compost bucket, and maybe even a community garden to spade it into, learning the name and ethos of that little brown bird in the backyard, traveling on foot through a forest, patching the elbows on a sweater and making do with it a little while longer. These are the kinds of disciplines and pleasures that invest a more frugal life way with meaning in relation to the earth. They are also a means of healing the human spirit, soul-polishing labors and meditations. Engaging in such practice, we can reclaim our intimacy with the earth and our community with one another. Imagine the sweetness and freedom in this reunion, the goodness in having a vocation that's a worthy basis for culture. Learning to provide for ourselves, to care for the places in which we live, and to restore them to biological health. Learning to thrive using the renewable energy flows of the elements, studying the natural histories of our home places, and discerning in them the outlines of our future self-reliance, consecrating large land areas across every continent as wilderness, shrines where entire ecosystems may continue in their evolutionary destiny. All of these actions aim at becoming native again to place. Bioregionalists call it re-inhabitation. Re-inhabitory humans make love to their home places, bringing forth a wealth of cultures, songs, images, teachings, inventions, musics, and cuisines. Part of the hope in spirit, paradoxically, is coming back to our senses and being able once again to revel in them. Remember this: to be alive can feel like such a piece of good fortune as to leave one breathless. To have a pounding heart and nerves that crackle with information and a skeleton strung with muscles strong enough to pump the pedals on the bike or swing the mall to split a little wood, to have eyes to scan the valley and register the subtleness of color change as September pushes fall forward, is the ultimate gift, a consummate luxury. To experience this bliss in life can and should be every human's birthright. In the invention and regeneration displayed in the wilderness, and the renewal displayed in the turning of the seasons, Earth spells her hope for us. In the persistent human yearning after the good, the true, and the beautiful, and the mounting struggles around the world for more decent, life-affirming society are spelled out our hopes for ourselves, hopes that are awakened today even in the young, in the very young. One early afternoon, not so very long ago, a cadre of four little girls wound their way up my long driveway to pay a call. Having learned that the home planet is endangered, they had taken it upon themselves to visit all the neighbors in a homegrown canvas to save the earth. So they had made a creative, positive, and quite touching response to the threat of planet doom. They were giving hand-colored drawings of the earth, captioned with childishly wise slogans, to each of us privileged to receive a visit. I got one that shows our blue and green planet rising in a field of eight yellow stars. "Save the Earth," reads the headline. "Pitch in, help out. A very little goes a long way. If you're interested, call. Don't stop trying." They say, somebody said, good art borrows, great art steals. So steal from the kids. They've got the wisdom. So about 15 minutes more, I think. Let me see. I have just finished a book. Or this summer, finished a book called Epicurean Simplicity, which will be published this February, or next February, by Island Press. And so I'd like to read a little bit from a forthcoming work. There's a lot of cancer around. The tumor in my mother's lung grew so slowly that her oncologist was a bit baffled. The slowness permitted our family 3/4 of a year to love Mama following her terminal diagnosis. Our family ran true to form, but with more gravity. The same day my mother informed me of her fatal illness, I learned that another feisty old woman, my great friend Ramona, had succumbed at last to her lung cancer. Ramona had gone about her dying in character too, with sometimes discomforting candor. Over the previous few years out in California, 5 men, former colleagues, highly gifted writers and editors and a designer, had all died in their early 50s of cancer. Nearer to home, another acquaintance was, as she mentioned almost in passing when we happened to speak, outliving her doctor-decreed lung cancer death sentence by a year and a half. Her composure about what she was facing was remarkable, and I said as much. "It was hard," she said. "The hardest part was not being able to assume a future, not being able to get around to doing this or that or the other thing someday." Of course, all of our days are as numbered as the hairs on our heads. Any healthy one of us could step out in traffic, slip in the bathtub, or be struck dead by a meteorite, leaving behind friends suffering from terminal cancer to attend our funerals. True enough, but most of us who can live toward the morrow and do assume the future. So far as I know, I have no life-threatening illness, yet as I savor the presence of nature in this place, I fear not that I may not pass this way again, but that this way itself is passing fast. The number of blazing pink surveyor's flags in the neighborhood, like the telltale lesions of Kaposi's sarcoma, do not augur well for such integrity of landscape as still remains. The property lines are being drawn and quartered. Heavy equipment, deforestation, erosion, and pole barns are bound to follow. "Growth for the sake of growth is the ideology of the cancer cell," said Edward Abbey. "As without, so within. The ideology of growth is willing to sacrifice lives for what is advertised as progress, whether they're human sacrifices sanctioned by the calculus of acceptable risk or the lives of the myriad creatures destroyed in the name of development. These malignancies of sprawl and terminal illness ordain that nothing in this life, be it my sense of myself or my immediate surroundings, will ever be the same again. As I write this, at more of a remove from my mother's death, the pain is resolving into tenderness. I can appreciate the change this loss wrought. I have standing now in the company of the bereaved, the knowledge of how it feels, and the sense of what might comfort another, even as I was comforted and helped to live on through the grief as time crawled painfully slowly from fall into winter and then a new year. That February blew warm, then cold. A freakish southwest wind dissipated the snow, exposed the weeds, and bared some earthy banks. The thaw consecrated the winter's accumulation of dust and crud, sullying the snow's surface, making all things drear. Around Valentine's Day, the cold came back with a vengeance. A front raced in, pushing a line of thunderstorms northeast across the region and towing a wave of bitter temperatures that froze the meltwater, the saturated ground, and the shrunken snows to ringing hardness. Finally, it blew in 4 or 5 inches of light, dry snow. The next day, the landscape was white again with fresh snow and the sun was shining. That afternoon, there was the clear possibility of a ski and there were plenty of needful things to do, but my first move was to escape from my sadness into a nap on the couch, balled up warm and oblivious under a heavy comforter. When I awoke, the sunlight was still playing through scattered clouds. There were still things needing to be done in the studio and in the house. However, I decided to accept the sweet magic maker's invitation to arise from the slough of despond and put on my skis. My one ironclad certainty that it's always a good idea to go for a swim has a winter corollary. Whenever possible, it's always a good idea to go for a ski. With its rhythmic engagement of all four limbs and involvement with H2O, though in its solid form, cross-country skiing is akin to swimming. The day had grown warmer during the sun's brief appearance. However cold that warmer was, the early evening was calm with the dread wind chill factor in abeyance. Out I went trying to dodge the most menacing patches of gray, rippled ice, gliding mostly, scraping sometimes. Sunset began to gild the treetops and tint the clouds. My sadness, that familiar dull ache in the gut, was with me, but it assumed a relative position among the efforts and sensations of movement, the piercing deliciousness of clean, cold breaths, and the intrigues of squirrel tracks and mouse tunnels unroofed by the thaw. More color flooded the surroundings as the sun slipped lower, and I wanted to keep moving in this rosy radiance as long as I possibly could. As I slid down the deep trail to the pond, I gained speed, too much. At the very second I was congratulating myself on my platonic relationship with gravity, I lost my balance and toppled backward into the snow. Awkwardly hauling myself back upright, I groaned out loud. Vertical once more, I skied the few dozen yards past the snow-bowed blackberry canes and bare-limbed poplar trees to the flat expanse of the pond, pink now with the last of the daylight. Across the pond, on the north-facing bank where a grove of young hemlocks grows, I noted a curlicue track moving out from under the trees and then onto the snowy, frozen, flat surface. Where it stopped was a motionless hank of dark fur. I skied around the edge of the pond to investigate and came upon a porcupine curled on its side. The porky had waddled around under the tree and out on the snowy, frozen surface of the pond and then collapsed. As I approached, it curled its body slightly and weakly flexed its forepaws. its shining eye was open. Without much thinking, I picked it up and cradled it in my mittens, crooning dismay and sympathy. Already I'd broken first aid rule number one, don't move the victim. The porcupine sighed and writhed. It was a beautiful creature with lush ebony fur on its face and belly and no wounds visible. The spines on its back and tail were relaxed. The porky was too feeble to bristle. I carried it a few paces back to the hemlocks and laid it gently in a small warmth and wind-sculpted hollow at the base of one of the trees. The porky stirred a little and sighed again. It sure looked to be dying. I couldn't think of anything to do except doff my skis and sit with the porcupine on the snow, hoping I hadn't hurt it by carrying it back here. A half dozen of its spines had lodged in my right mitten. Moments passed. The porky cringed and sighed and didn't breathe its last. I couldn't manage just to sit there. Should I try to give it shelter? Cover it with branches? Build an igloo? Melt some snow and give it water? Wasn't there something I could do? Put it out of its misery? Haul it to the wildlife shelter? Recite the Porky Paramita Sutra? This porcupine was a wild thing. It was dying and it had no need of me. It could not feel my sympathy and may have suffered from my impulsive cradling. If it was still aware of my presence, it was probably sore afraid. Fancy this, some big strange animal comes upon you in your death throes, scoops you up, lays you down in the place you just set out from, and then sits near you and stares anxiously. My sitting was melting the snow and chilling me to my foundation. Not only had I not brought along my vial of arnica for homeopathic first aid or any tobacco for a sacred offering, I had neither a ground cloth nor the yogic discipline to keep a vigil in the snow during the porcupine's last hours. No patience to await the final stillness, the dulling eyes. I got up and retraced the porcupine's erratic track, wandering the few feet from the base of the two young crossed trees to the hemlock where it now lay. There were a couple of yellowish spots in the snow. Was that urine? What had brought the porcupine to this extremity? Disease? Starvation? A fall? Thirst? Poison? However it comes, we've all got to die. My mother got to die, I get to die, and the porky accomplished its dying during the night-long hours after we met. Death is one of the great shaping powers on this planet and in the human mind. My mother's death and the deaths of friends have tinctured my consciousness. Although a couple of years have passed since Mama died, I'm only now assuming the fact of her silence. Even so, I miss her, especially her voice, every day. There's no way not to have a heavy heart for a long while after one's mother has died. This heart grew in her. There's no way out but through, taking one step after another, doing the next necessary thing. Mourning is like picking your way across a torrent, rock by rock, with the likelihood of a slip and a soaking, and the knowledge that there's a lot of stumbling yet to do, undercutting your will. You fall down and then gather your wits. You stand up and step forth, bruised, but without a better idea of what to do. And then you continue as the sun swings lower in the sky and the nights lengthen. Whatever its magnitude, the loss must be faced. Respite in the company of a friend is a blessing, but the reality of loss does not abate. The wood in the stove burns away. The ashes must be carried out and more wood carried in. What a mercy is the obviousness of dirty dishes, dusty floors, and dwindling firewood. It is a relief, a comforting simplicity of action to tend to the daily necessities. The call of life is strong in me, strong enough finally to trump grief and depression. long live the living. That's how life persists, in the bodies of the living and through the living of it. May all beings, mice and voles, chickadees and squirrels, grasses and streams, pines and poplars, fleas and coyotes, parents and offspring, blackberries and hemlocks, cats and porcupines, persist. And may I too persist a while in living this life my parents gave to me. Thank you. Your Sitzfleisch. I would entertain some questions. Yes.
Flyer said that you've written something called Turning Away from Technology.
Yes.
Could you talk about that a little, please? Is that a book, an essay, article?
It's a book, and it is the edited transcripts of a couple of conferences that were held in 1993 and 94, sponsored by the Foundation for Deep Ecology. Amongst ourselves, we called them the Luddite conferences. And in San Francisco and then in Devon, England, they each brought together about 25 of the leading technology and development critics from around the world, really, to just have a symposium making a radical critique of various technologies. And they were tremendously exciting discussions and fascinating people. And it seemed a shame to me that this stuff would just languish on tape, or, you know, somebody would suffer through the transcribing of it, and then it would languish. So with the help of the Foundation for Deep Ecology, I made a book out of that, introduced it and edited and supplied a kind of an integument for the dialogue. But I can brag about that book because, you know, 99.9% of the language and thought in it is from this galaxy of sages. And I think for anyone interested in a quick introduction to the field of technology criticism, Turning Away from Technology is a good bet. Alas, the index does not include proper names, because it would be a good way to get a quick sampling of thinkers like Fritjof Capra, Jerry Mander, Charlene Spretnik. Chet Bowers was one of the most interesting people there, whose recent book, Let Them Eat Data, is about the profound effects of computers pervading education. And it's still in print. It's published by Sierra Club Books. And actually, there are a couple of copies available. Oh, sold out? One copy available. Yes.
You mentioned Barry Lopez, who's a fine writer of the natural world. Are there any other writers like Barry Lopez that you read and appreciate and respect?
Once I overcome my envy, which is a huge moral undertaking. It's really hard to single them out. You know, my all-time favorite nature writing is Donald Culross Peaty's Trees of Eastern and Central North America, which I think is circa 1950 or something. A Sand County Almanac will never let you down. I love a lot of the writers in the Orion magazine constellation. are wonderful. I enjoy Robert Michael Pyle's writing greatly. Gosh, there are just so many of them. But you know, my dirty little secret is that I don't read a whole lot of nature writing. I read a lot of environmental history, you know, sort of less, just nonfiction in my field. And I go on novel jags too, you know, and I make these stunning discoveries like Joseph Conrad, you know, Charles Dickens, Robert Louis Stevenson, you know. Some of that, I find, you know, going back a century, you get some pretty stunning descriptions of the natural world and an evocation of a lost world. Just, you know, when Dickens in, Martin Chuzzlewit, maybe, talks about the journey from the country to England on foot, or to London, rather, on foot. You know, you get a sense of another world. And sometimes, too, you know, I think if nature were doing as well as nature writing, what a natural world it would be. You know, there's less and less nature and more literature about it. We need to reverse those ratios. There are Terry Tempest Williams will sweep you off your feet. I like Sue Hubbell. But another writer who's not strictly speaking a nature writer, I just adore, is Mae Barenboim, who's an entomologist and an irrepressible punster. So, you know, her books are like Bugs in the System and 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers. And, you know, it's just, it's entomological lore, but it's also these like shaggy louse stories that lead up to just horrendous punchlines, you know. Mae Barenboim. If you get into bugs, she's your gal. Yes.
In the 90s, a lot of the news discourse was sort of dominated by political soap opera and business, and now it's sort of turned into there's a new discourse that's arisen since September 11th. I'm wondering, how do you think the voice of deep ecology will find itself or be able to, how will the public be able to hear that voice
wow.
in the sort of society that we
have? Boy, well, one can hope, you know, faintly at first, but with ever increasing attention. It's a tough one because, I mean, you know, the idea of deep ecology is that you know, primal nature is sort of what the planet's about, and that all life is equal. In a sense, it's Darwinian. It's saying, you know, that all life is on an equal moral plane, and that human beings have only the right to take a minimal subsistence, and that other beings should be allowed to live out their evolutionary destiny. Well, you know, that's a very heretical philosophy. And what we're seeing now, you know, in one sense could be construed as the, you know, the apocalypse of anthropocentrism. You know, it's like humans are the alpha and omega, you know, and our conflicts, whether they be theological or economical, are more important than the persistence of the planet. And that, you know, it just is about time to start calling that stuff pathologically insane. And then duck and run like hell. I don't know, you know. Yes.
I think that human circumstance is more of an immediate concern. I think it's really on a minuscule scale in regards to the Earth and the universe itself. Like the chances, they say that, okay, the Earth will someday, all the planets someday, due to the gravitational pull of the sun, will, be drawn into the sun's surface and burn out and all that stuff. But the chances of us actually witnessing that is like never.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, anything that expounds or that occurs outside of our own personal circumstance, referring to humans specifically, I think that it's really not of a major concern.
Hmm.
I mean, only when it involves, like you mentioned earlier, like a meteor or something from space
mm-hmm.
coming to totally just wiping us off the face of the earth.
Hmm.
I mean, other than that, it's like human circumstances pretty much regulated and overseen by higher authorities and managed properly.
Mm. Well, I guess we'll have to agree to disagree on that. An interesting view. Yes, madam.
I wonder if you have anything to say about the overpopulation that's occurring in the world of people.
Mm.
And that this is affecting the natural world just without anybody really trying to destroy it.
Mm. Do I have any pieces of optimism? Well, let's see. I heard Lewis Mumford once say on tape that he was pessimistic about probabilities and optimistic about possibilities. You know, and so I remain optimistic about possibilities, and when I get a chance to get with younger people, who are acting on their conscience, I feel less isolated, and nature itself is a source of optimism. My desideratum would be climax forests everywhere and very few people, very relatively few human beings, a sustainable human population, which would be a lot smaller than 6 billion people. However, that being said, and I may not get what I want in this lifetime, every time I'm one of those sentimental fools. Every time I see a dandelion growing out of a crack, I think chlorophyll has its own wisdom and is fraught with possibility. And certainly the whole field of ecological restoration is great cause for optimism. Last year, I had a chance to speak at a Northern Illinois Prairie Restoration Conference. It was the 11th annual or so. Every year, this thing has outgrown its venues. There is more prairie being planted now than plowed under. So the idea of restoration is very captivating, and it captivates people of any age. So I think that is one, that's one great place to go, in search of hope, because you really can see things regenerate of their own, with a little bit of help and a lot of kind of their own natural self-will. About overpopulation, that is really where I came into the ecology movement in 69. And I think it's the most intractable issue, and it is unquestioned. The human species has unquestionably exceeded the planet's carrying capacity. Our species alone appropriates 40% of the planet's net photosynthetic output. You know, it's just an immense disproportion. And so what do you do about it? Well, I think women's liberation is an important thing to do about it, you know. And when I got into the field, and you talked, any talk about population control conjured a very repressive scenario. And there were some blundering things done in the third world of just broad brush, insensitively provided birth control clinics, that kind of thing, and sterilization campaigns, the infamous, you know, sterilization campaigns in India and all of that sort of thing. So, you know, it was tarred with a real brush. But in the subsequent 30 years, there's kind of a consensus emerging internationally that if women are economically empowered and educated, and if maternal and child health is provided for, that, you know, smaller families will follow. I also think that this is another, you know, it's just another truth that needs to be articulated over and over again. It's an issue that keeps going away. But one of the most useful sort of formulas for thinking about that was given in one of Paul and Ann Ehrlich's books, is that the, you know, human impact is a function of population times degree of affluence times degree of technological advance. So there are like really three variables in human impact. So impoverished people have a less dramatic impact on the planet collectively than affluent people. And perhaps you've heard it said that, you know, for everybody on the planet to live at a North American level of affluence would require, you know, 2.5 more Earths. I mean, it's just, you know, to promote this way of life as something that's generally attainable is radically wrong, and it's one of the pretexts for economic globalization, which is another big topic that needs some looking into. Yes.
What technology do you see posing the greatest threats right now?
Wow. Well, there are so many, it's really hard to choose, you know. If I'm looking out my front door, I think earth-moving equipment might qualify. But so-called defense technology, you know, weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, you know, coming hard on the heels of that, I would say, genetically modified organisms. You'd say what? Rubber?
Like tires.
Like tires?
Like innovation of tires.
Well, good one, yeah. Stuff. Yeah. Yeah, well, automobiles, certainly. I don't know, it's kind of, it's a, you know, it should be kind of a David Letterman style thing of counting back from number 10, you know. In some ways, you know, mass communication technologies are such a double-edged sword because whatever else they do, they homogenize human cultures and human imaginations. In a sense, I mean, if my sense of the way evolution is shaped us and the planet is for lots of diversity and lots of very place-specific adaptation. And it's no coincidence that as fast as wild places are disappearing, human languages are disappearing. You know, they're so all the phenomenal human intelligence about how to live in a measure of equilibrium with specific places in fairly renewable ways is vanishing with those places, and it's also being swept away by, you know, global MTV and the marketing of this kind of consumerist way of life. And it forecloses a lot more options than it opens, I think. But one last, if there is one. Yes.
In New England and the United States. And yet it seems to me that that's the result of sort of neglect. How do you see restorative ecology in the hands of humans? I mean, how do we do restorative ecology and then back out?
Mm. Together. Yeah. Well, the late, great David Brower had this notion that, you know, what the Earth really needs now is CPR, you know, conservation, preservation, and restoration. So he saw those as kind of three legs of the approach, that whatever, you know, wild remains has got to be preserved, because that's really the standard for the planet, you know, the planet's places, climax, ecosystems. And then, you know, what can be restored needs to be restored, and then what parts of the landscape can be used in sustainable ways should be used with a conservation ethic. And I mean, this is a big field, and a lot of, you know, many, many good minds are elaborating it. But the work of the Wildlands Project is very interesting in kind of mapping big wilderness and applying the insights of the theory of island biogeography to the creation of preserves and the linking of preserves. Because preservation needs to be done at an adequate scale, and preserves need to be linked, so there's not, you know, a genetic degradation of the big critters that you're trying to preserve and that are the keystones of ecosystem health. So the vision is of a landscape that would have within it regions that are good, wild, and sacred, to use Gary Snyder's formulation. You know, the sacred lands would be the ones that are preserved, you know, and extremely, you know, seldom visited and only on a, you know, a wilderness basis, where there could be human involvement, but the playing field would have to be level, you know, in the sense that you would go in with a minimum of equipment, maybe naked, you know. and the good, you know, the wild land would be a place where there could be a sustainable foraging, you know. And it's not so far-fetched. I mean, right now there are, people making very sound arguments that the forests of the Pacific Northwest can yield more per acre in terms of forest products like wild-crafted herbs and fungi than they do as timber. So, you know, that it's not totally whacked out. Another idea of how humans might fit in a restored landscape is glimmering in a concept called the Buffalo Commons that Frank and Deborah Popper at Rutgers University advanced very controversially about, I don't know, 10 years ago. The idea, and they're demographers and sociologists, they've seen that the short grass prairie does not work as an agricultural economy. And so all those counties are losing population rapidly. So their vision, and it's actually being taken up by some of the tribes there, is that it should be a buffalo commons, you know, that the species that was the dominant there might be reinstated, the fences taken down, and that, you know, some degree of harvest of that meat and a lot of ecotourism might obtain, you know. I mean, your point about McKibben's point about the eastern forest is a real interesting one, because in some sense it means that the rural economy of New England just up and croaked, you know, and that the process of industrialization succeeded in moving people off and out of an inhabitory relationship with the land. So it's not altogether good news. But again, you know, it sort of comes back to the question of carrying capacity. Sooner or later, we got to look at what's the human carrying capacity of a given watershed, a given region. And these are taxing ideas and threatening ideas and you know, huge, hard questions. And, you know, and it's why, I mean, one of the things that gives me cause for optimism is that people in our time have paid a lot of attention. I mean, activists in our time have paid a lot of attention to how to become better listeners, better communicators, you know, how to learn to work better in groups. I mean, I think that that's absolutely crucial. And it is going on, you know, different styles of activism and a profound commitment to nonviolence, I think, are, you know, causes for optimism. And to me, you know, what that stands for is getting in league with the life force of the planet instead of trying to subjugate it. Thank you.